Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's date is Tuesday the 25th of January 2022 and you're listening to me, Svan Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's episode in our Greatest Britain series is the second part of a trilogy on Captain Scott and his final fateful Terra Nova expedition. And as always, my co-host for the show is Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max? Get into a better time?
Yes, that would be great.
Let's talk some more about Captain Robert Falcon Scott and his Terra Nova expedition. Last week we heard how Scott picked some of his crew from among his donors and how some of the men's wives accompanied them to meet up with the Terra Nova. The ship itself had sprung a leak on the way around to New Zealand and had to go into dry dock, and it became apparent that there was a lack of urgency about the trip, despite the race being on to see who would get to the South Pole first. When they finally left harbour, the ship was heavily laden with supplies and coal, and the women ended up having a fight a few days before the men left, and we left them just as they finally steamed off towards the South Pole. Do you want to add anything to that, Max, or should we get straight into it?
No, let's get straight into it. That seems okay.
Okay, well, other than a little seasickness, the first few days at sea went quite well. However, on December the 2nd, they were hit by a huge storm that dislodged the deck cargo, creating dangerous conditions topside. The seas crashed over the decks, tossing the dogs from one side to the other, as water poured into the engine room and the cabins below. The ponies suffered the most, and when all was said and done, one dog had been lost overboard while two ponies had been killed. Meanwhile, the seawater mixed with the coal dust, thereby creating a sludge that choked the bilge pumps. Water quickly rose to the furnaces, and for the first time the men were in fear of losing their ship. They finally resorted to using buckets to bail the water out by hand, and by morning the seas had begun to settle down. By 10 p.m. that evening, Williams and Davies had succeeded in cutting a hole through the engine room bulkhead, which allowed Teddy Evans a big enough hole to crawl through so he could actually reach the pumps. Standing up to his neck in water, Teddy was able to clear the valves, and to the joy of all, a good steam of water came from the pump for the first time. Afterwards, Raymond Priestley wrote that the ship at her worst would have given Dante a good idea for another Circle of Hell, though he would have been at a loss to account for such a cheerful and ribald lot of souls. Bowers wrote, "Under its worst conditions, this earth is a good place to live in." Wilson wrote, "I must say, I enjoyed it all from the beginning to end." I think this was because he was one of the few who did not suffer from seasickness. About 10 tons of coal were lost, 65 gallons of petrol, and a case of biologist's spirits. And this reminds me of something I was actually talking to my parents about the other day. If you will recall, in the first expedition, they took a piano with them. And I thought this was just for listening to people play the piano. And my parents were saying, well, no, that was for singing songs, because singing songs lifts the spirits. That's what the piano was there for, for them to lift their spirits. And also, when this sort of thing would have been happening, they would have been singing songs. And that's how they would have kept up their good cheer. And I mean, years ago, everybody used to sing. When people were walking along, they used to sing. I mean, I'm talking about 100 years ago here. There was no idea that anybody could earn or own music. There was no copyright on music. There were just various different songs that people would sing, and it would raise the spirits. And I dare say, when this was going on, that they would have burst into song, and that would have kept their morale high. So they wouldn't have let this get to them in any way, which is what they say in their descriptions here. Do you want to add to that, Max?
I just agree with you, basically, that taking musical instruments, having somebody within your group who is who can play a musical instrument, and if you've got more people than one that can play a musical instrument, all the better. But you know, just having one person in your group, if you are facing hardship, who can play a musical instrument and therefore provide you with the ability to have a sing song, then that definitely does lift people's spirits.
Yeah, I bet they would sing before they ate. I bet they would sing for their supper, I should imagine, all around the piano, and that would help to lift the spirits. But on December the 8th, the first iceberg was spotted. And on the following day, in latitude 65 degrees 8 seconds, the Terra Nova entered the pack ice. For the next 3 weeks, the ship had to be shoved and bashed through a massive amount of ice, consuming a great deal of the precious coal in the process. On December the 30th, Scott wrote, "We are out of the pack ice at length, and at last one breathes again." On New Year's Day 1911, Mount Erebus came into view. They attempted to land at Cape Crozier, where they had planned on setting up winter quarters, but the seas were just too rough, so McMurdo Sound was the next option. Rounding the northwest tip of Ross Island, they proceeded down the coast past Cape Royds, Inaccessible Island, and Cape Barn. When they arrived at the Squarey, soon renamed Cape Evans, Scott, Evans, and Wilson made the decision to set up the winter quarters there. About a mile and a half of ice lay between the shore and the open sea. And on January the 4th, the Terra Nova anchored to the ice and the unloading began. The ponies were especially happy to finally be on firm ground as they rolled and kicked in the snow. I bet that was a great relief for them. And the dogs as well. You imagine they've been cooped up on that ship all this time. The first two motor sledges were unloaded and immediately put to work hauling stores to the new camp. As the third and largest sledge was unloaded and hauled by 20 men towards the shore, it decided to break through the ice and sink in 60 fathoms of seawater. Scott blamed himself for the tragedy, as he was in a hurry to get the ship unloaded so that she could embark with Campbell and his crew for King Edward the Seventh Land. The hut went up rapidly. It measured 50 foot by 25 and was 9 foot to the eaves. It was insulated with quilted seaweed and lined with matchboard, lit by acetylene gas, provided with a stove and cooking range, and divided into two by a partition made of crates, including the wine, to separate the men's from the officers' quarters. Within 2 weeks, the hut was built and occupied. And if you remember, on the other ship, they actually built the hut on the ship, didn't they? So they wouldn't have to spend 2 weeks doing it once they actually got to where they were going. Before starting on the depot-laying journey across the barrier and towards the pole, Scott and Mears travelled the 15 miles south to revisit Hut Point, and Scott was furious to find a window had been left open. Snow had drifted in and frozen into a solid block of ice. Scott knew that no one was to blame other than Shackleton, since he was the last to use the hut when he had based at Cape Evans 3 years earlier. Scott wrote, "It is difficult to conceive the absolutely selfish frame of mind that can perpetrate a deed like this. Finding that such a simple duty had been neglected by one's immediate predecessors disgusted me horribly." I think that's a little bit harsh, because I don't think he would have done that deliberately. I mean, it's saying it's selfish here, and I don't think it's probably selfishness. It was just absent-mindedness, because I don't think they would have deliberately done that. So I think he is being a bit harsh. But then they should have been careful enough not to do something like that, because you know that one mistake in these conditions can lead to death. So they need to be absolutely 100% all the time, checking everything, not making mistakes. So I think you can criticize him for that. But to say that he was selfish to do that, you know, I would say, what would be the word for that rather than selfish? Incompetent?
I think absent-minded is what you said. It is a matter that... it may well be that at the point when Shackleton left, it was a struggle for them to get all of the various things they had to take with them loaded onto the sledges or whatever that they were going to take it away with. And there could have been a howling gale at the time. There could have been a blizzard raging, at which point he may not have been able to see that the window was open. And or it may have been that somebody had done the catch up and it looked as if the window was closed, but it then blew open in a gale that followed. You don't know, really, do you? But to say that he was selfish indicates that he did it deliberately, whereas I would agree with you that almost certainly that would have been done accidentally.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think it could have been that blizzard thing. They could have thought that it was closed and then there was like heavy winds and that would have blown it open. That sounds like the most realistic reason. On January 24th, the depot-laying party got away, with all the dogs and 8 ponies, across the glacier tongue and onto the barrier. 2 days later, Scott and a team of dogs went back to the ship across the ice to say goodbye to Lieutenant Pennell and his crew. Scott figured that by the time they returned from the depot laying, the Terra Nova would have already deposited Campbell and his 5 companions, Raymond Priestley, Surgeon Levick, Browning, Dickerson and Abbott, somewhere in King Edward VII Land and would be on her return voyage to New Zealand. Also on board were Griffith Taylor, Frank Debenham, Charles Wright and Edgar Evans, who were to do scientific work in the mountains of Victoria Land. 2 days later, the depot-laying party was on the barrier, establishing a camp far enough from its edge to be out of any danger of the ice breaking free. They called this the safety camp, and it was from here that they made their final plans for the push to the pole. The first doubts about the ponies came as they sank into the soft snow and floundered. One of them actually went lame, and although a complete set of snowshoes for the ponies had been unloaded from the ship, all but one set were left back at Cape Evans. The lone set of snowshoes were attached to Weary Willie with astounding results, so Mears and Wilson headed back to base camp for the others. But when they arrived at the glacier tongue, they found that all the sea ice had broken away, leaving no path to reach the camp at Cape Evans. I mean, that is bad luck there. So you wouldn't imagine that, would you? Because you think you're standing on ground, solid ground, but it's actually ice, and that's melted away. So Mears and Wilson returned to safety camp, shoeless, and on February the 2nd, the party set forth with 5 weeks' worth of provisions, leaving behind 2 very disappointed men.
Atkins, just on that point of the horses' snowshoes, I find it sort of incongruous, the thought of a horse wearing a snowshoe. You know, horses' feet, if you've ever watched a horse walking, particularly their hind legs, that they almost clip. You know, that one hoof almost clips the other hoof as they walk, and there isn't a lot of room between the two front feet either when a horse is walking. So I would have thought that a horse would have to be taught how to walk in snowshoes, but you know, that's just me, I suppose.
Well, we'd have to see the design of it, wouldn't we? Because I know what you mean. When the back legs go up, it's sort of quite close to the other leg. But if they were long, I guess maybe they wouldn't have needed to be that much wider than the actual horse's foot itself, because they're sort of circular, aren't they? So they just need to be like a little bit wider. And that would make life easier for them. But I guess this was the first time that it actually had the ponies out there. You would imagine that they would have tried, you know, had a trial with this in Scandinavia, maybe, in the snow there.
But if Weary Willie was wearing them and was able to fare much better than the other ponies, obviously they do work. So I've never seen or ever heard of horses having snowshoes before, that's all.
Yeah, I'm going to have to do some research into that after this episode, I think. Well, as we say, there are 2 very disappointed men that were left behind, Atkinson with a sore heel and Crean to look after him. They marched in an easterly direction until they arrived at Corner Camp, where their first blizzard arrived, which kept them confined for 3 days. From Corner Camp, they marched due south for 10 nights to make their final depot, but the ponies were becoming visibly weak, 3 in particular. At Camp 11, Scott decided to send them back with their escorts and push on with the remaining 5. For the next couple of days, conditions worsened with heavy snow, and soon Weary Willie, led by Gran, was overtaken by Mears and Wilson with the dogs. The wolf and the dogs then broke loose as they pounced upon the poor pony. The men were able to get the dogs off, but not before the pony had been badly bitten. So we'll just stop there. That's another thing that they hadn't foreseen, that the dogs would go after the ponies. And also, I think this tells us how quick the ponies were, faster than the dogs. So it was a good idea to bring them, really. But you still would have thought they would have tested them out.
Well, I suppose what that tends to indicate, really, is that the huskies that they use, aren't that domesticated, aren't as domesticated as lots of other dog breeds are, and that there's still a wild instinct within the huskies, so that when they see an animal staggering and unable to run away, that then they regard that as being a signal for the dogs to attack the animal and pull it down in the way that they would do if they were wolves.
Yeah, not so domesticated as you would think, looking at those cute huskies. Well, next day, the ponies were able to proceed, but at Camp 15 on February 17th, Scott decided to turn back before reaching, as he had hoped, the 80th parallel. At 79 degrees, 28.5 seconds, 142 miles from Hut Point, they built a cairn and deposited more than 1 ton of stores, and this was to be called One Ton Depot. By this time, Oates' nose had become frostbitten, as well as Bauer's ears, and besides, Scott wanted to get back to Cape Evans to learn of any news left by Pennell concerning Campbell's party at King Edward VII Land. On the fourth day of the return trip, 12 miles from safety camp, Wilson saw Mears and Scott's dogs disappear, one after the other, exactly like rats running down a hole, only I saw no hole. They simply went into the white surface and disappeared. The sledge hung precariously at the edge of the crevasse, while 8 dogs were left dangling in the abyss, howling and struggling. 2 of the dogs had slipped their harness and fell 40 feet to a ledge, where they curled up and went to sleep. Wilson and Cherry Garrard came to the rescue and hauled the 8 dogs out with great difficulty, but there still remained the issue of the 2 dogs left on the ledge, some 65 feet below. Wilson protested, but Scott insisted on being lowered down into the chasm to retrieve the dogs. But as soon as the dogs had been hauled out, they engaged in a fight with Wilson's team. Scott was left dangling in the abyss as the others rushed in to separate the dogs. Finally, Scott was hauled in, and the next day they reached safety camp, where they found Teddy Evans, Ford, and Kiahani waiting for them. The 3 reported to Scott that only 1 of the 3 ponies had survived the return trip, as the others had died from exhaustion. Well, this shows us something about Scott, doesn't it? I mean, he's risking his life there to rescue the dogs. And I mean, he's the most important man here. Should he have risked his life to do that? But I guess he was going to be the guy to do this. He wasn't going to expect anybody else to risk their life doing this. And they are having a lot of bad luck, aren't they? You know, as soon as the dogs are hauled out, instead of being pleased that they're being rescued, they have a fight with Wilson's team. And interestingly, it was Wilson that was protesting about rescuing them as well.
Yes.
So perhaps...
From Scott's point of view, had Scott not risked his life going down into the crevasse, people would have said, oh, he tells us to do things that he isn't prepared to do himself. And so to a certain extent, Scott needed to prove his courage as far as the other men were concerned. But if he, you know, if he had refused, if he had gone in, as you say, and it had a calamitous end where he'd been killed, then that would have been regarded as the wrong thing to do, because as the leader of the group, he could have been, you know, it could be asserted that he should have got somebody else to do it, somebody who wasn't as irreplaceable as he was. But so he was in a situation where it was, you know, he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. And, you know, he showed his mettle by doing it and doing it successfully.
Well, they had to do something, didn't they? I mean, otherwise the dogs would have starved down there, and they would have been tortured. It was either try and go down and rescue them, I guess, or shoot the dogs. And he certainly couldn't shoot the dogs. And also, I mean, he's trying to set a really good example here as well. I mean, we'll hear later on how this is what it was all about. It was setting the best example they could for the English nation. These were English men that were the cream of the crop. They understood that, and they wanted to set a good example for the men back home, for them to live up to. And this was very important to them. So they had to be seen to be doing the right thing. And I guess, again, this is why Scott was so upset that Shackleton had decided that he was going to go over the same patch that Scott had been on, because these were gentlemen and they had gentlemen's rules about doing things. The chivalry was still alive, I think we can see from this. And also, a dog is a man's best friend. So he had to go and rescue them, really, didn't he? Well, they also had no news on Campbell. So after a meal and a few hours of sleep, they went on to Hut Point, pulling the sledges themselves. When they reached the hut, they found it to be empty. A note was pinned to the wall which said, "Mail for Captain Scott is in a bag inside the south door." But there was no bag and no mail. So back they went to safety camp, where they found Atkinson and Crean with the mail. Every incident of the day pales before the startling contents of the mailbag, Scott wrote. In the bag was a letter from Victor Campbell. The Terra Nova had sailed along the barrier as far as King Edward VII Land, but found it impossible to go ashore. They turned back and on February the 3rd sailed into the Bay of Wales, only to find a ship anchored to the ice, which they recognised as Amundsen's Fram. Campbell, Livick and Pennell had breakfast in the Fram, and Amundsen with two companions had lunch in the Terra Nova. Amundsen offered to give Scott some dogs, and Pennell offered to take the Fram's mail to New Zealand. Amundsen reported that his attempt for the pole would not take place until the following Antarctic summer. As it turns out, the Bay of Wales was the proper place for a starting point and an attempt for the pole, but Scott was afraid that too much was at risk to set up base camp at that location. It was afloat, and large chunks of it broke off each year going out to sea. However, Amundsen knew that the bay, charted by Ross in 1841, was still in the same position when Borch Grevink landed there in 1900, and when Shackleton sailed by in 1908 and named it the Bay of Wales. Besides, the bay was 60 miles closer to the pole than McMurdo Sound. Raymond Priestley was impressed when Amundsen drove his dogs up next to the Terra Nova for lunch. When he arrived next to the ship, he gave a whistle, and the whole team stopped as one dog. He turned the sledge upside down and left the dogs in their tracks to remain there, without fighting, until he had finished his lunch. Dogs, plenty of dogs, well-trained dogs, was very impressive. As much attention was given to the dogs as to the men on the Fram. A false deck had been built above the real one to protect the dogs in stormy seas, an awning had been erected to protect them from the sun, and their diet was a carefully balanced mixture of dried fish, pemmican, and lard. When he read the news, Scott wrote, "There is no doubt that Amundsen's plan is a very serious menace to ours." Although Scott took the news in good stride, many of the others were very angry and wanted to march right into the Bay of Wales and have it out once and for all with Amundsen. Cherry Garrard wrote, "We had just paid the first instalment of making a path to the pole, and we felt, however unreasonably, that we had earned the first right of way." So I think this really shows that Amundsen had really thought more ahead than Scott. And he trained his dogs and he looked after his dogs. And I mean, they really care about the dogs here, don't they? With the false deck to protect them from the seas. And, you know, imagine on the Terra Nova, they were just in the kennels, like flying about on the decks. And also it shows that Amundsen is quite chivalrous, because he knows that the Terra Nova have lost some dogs. So he's saying, well, I'll give you mine. But also, I mean, he's 60 miles ahead of Scott's team, isn't he? Being moored up there in the Bay of Wales. And really, perhaps Scott should have thought of that.
Yes, yeah, so that was bad playing on Scott's part, really. But, you know, Scott probably thought that he would take the route that he knew in preference to the route that he didn't know, but which is perhaps shorter, and that was perhaps a mistake.
Well, also they're thinking, well, we've just laid our depots, we're here first, but their depots probably don't even get them as far as the Bay of Wales, maybe a little bit further. So I don't know how long Amundsen had actually been there for. I mean, he may have got there before they got there. But everybody was on now. Everybody was racing towards the South Pole because the North Pole had been achieved by this point.
Yeah.
Scott now had to get everyone back to Hut Point. On the last day of February, the move began with Mears and Wilson leading off with the dog teams. Wilson went around by Cape Armitage and arrived safely at Hut Point. The others followed with the ponies and had to follow the sea ice route. They had barely started when Weary Willie collapsed and died. While Scott, Oates and Gran stayed by Weary Willie's deathbed, Bowers, Crean and Cherry Garrard went on ahead with the four surviving ponies and the loaded sledges. They dropped down off the barrier onto the sea ice and started to probe their way around to Cape Armitage. When the ponies could go no further, they camped and turned in, but were aroused 2 hours later by a strange noise. When they stepped outside, it was discovered that the ice had broken up and their camp was now adrift on a floe. One of the ponies had disappeared and survival seemed unlikely. The only hope was to take the three remaining ponies and four sledges and hop from floe to floe as they made their way back to the barrier. 6 hours passed before they made it to the edge of the barrier, and using sledges as ladders, Scott and the others were able to climb onto the barrier, but the ponies drifted away on their floe as hungry killer whales stood by. Scott replied, "Of course we shall have a run for our money next season, but so far as the pole is concerned, I have little hope." Next morning, Bowers spotted the pony's floe resting against a spur jutting out from the barrier. Bowers and Oates were able to make their way out across the floes and reach the ponies. Unfortunately, one pony immediately fell in, so Oates had to kill him with his pickaxe. Meanwhile, the other two ponies were brought back to the brink of safety. Both were hauled out, but one could not get to his feet. The pony would slip and fall back into the water with each attempt, and when the killer whales showed up, Bowers shouted, "I can't leave him alive to just be eaten by those whales." Bowers grabbed the axe and killed him. When all was said and done, only one pony had survived. They had started their depot laying journey with eight of them, but they went back to the hut point with just two. So, I mean, they're taking a lot of risks here over these animals, aren't they? And they've obviously got very emotionally involved with them, with Scott waiting there with Weary Willie to die. And, I mean, these are the sort of risks that they have here as well, that the ice floe could just break up and half your camp could end up floating out to sea. So they were particularly lucky to be able to catch the ponies again the next day. But then they ended up losing them. And as well, they're using up all their energy doing this. It's they're going from one bit of bad luck to the other, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I was surprised they took horses with them or ponies with them, because horses and ponies are a lot less hardy than you would think. You know, in their own environment, in a cold, temperate climate, a horse or a pony is, ideally suited to that kind of environment. But horses can die of all sorts of maladies that you just that just seem so strange. I'm just trying to think. Well, there's a malady that horses can get if they just eat the wrong kind of hay. They can get some kind of intestinal problem which can cause them to die. And so taking them into that kind of an alien environment, I would have thought was quite a high risk thing to do. And I was, when we first started reading through this information, I was surprised to find that they had taken horses and ponies with them.
No, they would need a lot of fodder for them. But I guess he's thinking, well, we're going to get the best of both worlds here. We've got motor sledges, we've got ponies, and we've got dogs, and we've got men. And of course, the first of the motor sledges just sank through the ice. So that's no good. But I guess today that's what you would use, wasn't it? And the design of the motorized sledges, they are actually used today for snowmobiles. And that was really, yeah, the first snowmobile. So they were sort of ahead of their time there. But they're gradually losing all their resources for actually getting to the South Pole. Shall we get into our greatest Britons?
Well, let's talk about Captain Scott again, yes.
Yeah, let's get more into Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition. And in the last episode, we heard how when the Terra Nova finally got to the Antarctic and started unloading, the first of the bad luck set in, with one of the motor sledges falling through the ice. Soon after this, they discovered the ponies did not suit the snow, and only one set of snowshoes had been left with them, the rest going off with the ship to Cape Evans. And we wondered what the snowshoes looked like, and we thought they might be in a capital D shape. But I had a look on Google Images, and they looked more similar to wheels to me, but I was just looking at one image, and it was just sort of showing you one snowshoe that was in a wheel shape. And you were telling me that there were others that were in a D shape, and it might have been the wheel shape that was at the front and the D shape that was at the back, Max. Is that correct?
Yes, after we'd spoken about this before, I Googled snowshoes for horses, and it appeared that there were two types. The circular snowshoes where the horse's hoof would have been in the centre of the circle, so it would therefore just make the contact patch much larger. But it appeared to me that the snowshoes on the rear feet of the horse were in the D shape. And I think from the conversation we had before, I've mentioned that how the rear hooves of horses almost clip each other as horses walk. You know, their rear feet seem to be closer together than their front feet are. And so that could well be that there would be two different shapes of shoe for the horses.
So you'd have a front shoe and a back shoe. So that solves that problem that we were asking about in the last episode. The dogs fell down a crevasse, and after Scott rescued them, they then attacked the ponies. Only one of the ponies survived, and to top everything off, the expedition's main competitor, Amundsen, had arrived with perfectly trained dogs and a plan to head for the pole in the summer from a much closer position than Scott's starting point. Finally, even more ponies died, this time after floating out on a block of ice and being harassed by killer whales. So things really have not taken a turn for the better once they actually arrived there in the Antarctic. And now we will continue with our story here. Now they waited at Hut Point for the sea ice to freeze over again so they could continue on to Cape Evans. On March the 15th, they were joined by the geologists Griffith Taylor, Frank Debenham and Charles Wright, along with Petty Officer Edgar Evans, who had been exploring the Western Mountains in Victoria Land. On April the 11th, Scott and half the party were able to get away for Cape Evans with the rest to follow. When they reached the base, they found the hut in good shape, but one of the ponies and another dog had died. That left just 10 ponies for them out of the original 19. On April 23rd, the sun vanished beneath the horizon for the last time until August. Scott wrote that the sledging season had come to an end, that is, except for one trip led by Wilson to Cape Crozier in search of birds. And that adventure is best told in a book written by Cherry Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World. A great deal of scientific work was accomplished during the winter at Cape Evans. Scott's diary is full of scientific data. He was constantly thinking and observing as he went on solitary walks, recording all the things seen. He had a passion for science and was sensitive to nature and beauty alike. His spiritual growth was boundless. And we have a quote here. "There is infinite suggestion in this phenomenon, the Aurora Borealis. Mysterious, no reality. It is the language of mystic signs and of portents, the inspiration of the gods. Wholly spiritual, divine signalling." Needless to say, hours and hours of preparation were put into the plans for the push to the pole, but always his thoughts came back to transport, as during the winter, three more dogs had died. Six men missing from the hut at Cape Evans were Victor Campbell and his five companions, who, having failed to get ashore on King Edward VII Land, had been taken by the Terra Nova to Cape Adare, where they established their base near Borch Grevink's old camp. The Eastern Party had thus become the Northern Party, and it had been arranged that the Terra Nova would pick up Campbell's party from Cape Adare on her return from New Zealand in early 1912. So it's interesting here that we see that he's appreciating the beauty there and the spiritual side of it. And I guess you would have a lot of solitude there, as well as the camaraderie with the people. And during the winter, there's really not that much for them to do. They're just there waiting for the summer to come when they can make this attempt on the pole. And also, don't forget, we've got Amundsen, who is much closer to the South Pole now, and he's going to make his journey in the summer as well. So it must have been a lot of thoughts going around his head. And when you imagine half the ponies have died and a lot of the dogs as well, he's really not starting out with the best of resources to actually get there.
It certainly is a process of attrition that they're going through, and it is taking them a long time to make the preparations for the journey south to try and get to the South Pole. And part of the, they're having to spend a lot of time thinking, and it's probably a good job that they do have some time to think, because that they would need to then plan to make up for the losses that they would have suffered as a result of this attrition.
And it's also good that we have all these diaries and journals that they kept, so we can get an understanding of what they were going through. Geology, with 25-year-old Raymond Priestley in charge, was to be the main preoccupation, and surgeon Murray Levick was to study birds and marine life. So the winter at Cape Evans passed. Scott celebrated his 43rd birthday with his companions, and he wrote, "They are boys, all of them, but such excellent, good-natured ones. There has been no sign of sharpness or anger, no jarring note in all these wordy contests. All end with a laugh." A Discovery Expedition custom Scott revived was the issue of the South Polar Times. The sun returned on Victor Campbell's 36th birthday, August the 23rd, and Scott fixed the date of departure for the pole as November the 1st, 1911, at the latest. They could not start earlier because the ponies would not survive the cold. So to fill in the time, Scott, Bowers, Simpson and Edgar Evans left on September the 15th on a remarkably pleasant and instructive little spring journey to the Western Mountains. It was probably on this trip that Scott picked his companions for the final push to the pole. Wilson was a given, Edgar Taff Evans too, the sterling sledger, strong as an ox. Bowers, the only man Scott could rely on to grasp details and remember them. And he says, "The greatest source of pleasure to me is to realise that I have such men as Bowers and P.O. Evans for the southern journey." But at the end of October 1911, Scott called his men together to give them some bad news. The expedition was under heavy financial strain and had literally run out of funding. Those men capable of foregoing their salary for the coming year were asked to do so. Some had already decided to return with the Terra Nova when she called in that summer. Griffith Taylor was expected back at his university. Ponting and Day's work was finished, while Clissold and Ford were in poor health. Most of the others volunteered to stay another winter, even if they received no pay. I mean, this is shocking, isn't it? You think today, if you're going out on a scientific mission, the government are going to pay you for it. But they've gone out on this mission, they've had to get all private funding for it, and now they've run out of the funding, and he's just asking people to volunteer. At least on that first Discovery expedition, it was all paid for by the government. It was all paid for by the Navy. I mean, do you imagine going for a year without pay in these conditions?
Mind you, I suppose having become part of the party and having gone down there and endured what they have endured, it would become a kind of mission that you would have. I mean, it obviously was a mission as far as Scott was concerned, that he was prepared to sort of put his life on the line to achieve. But also the other people, they would also, living in close proximity with him for that length of time, they would have probably become equally obsessed with the mission of being the first people to get to the South Pole. And I can imagine that somebody, if they were going to be fed and they were going to and that they were so close to achieving their objective, that's, you know, just one more final push would do it. I can imagine people being prepared to do that for nothing.
Well, it was a very, very important expedition that they were on. And of course, they wanted to be the first there as well. They wanted to beat Amundsen. Before the departure of the Southern Party, Scott, like all the others, wrote to his family and friends. He acknowledged in his letter to Kathleen, "I don't know what to think of Amundsen's chances. If he gets to the pole, it must be before we do, as he is bound to travel fast with dogs and pretty certain to start early. On this account, I decided at a very early date to act exactly as I should have done had he not existed. Any attempt to race must have wrecked my plan. Besides which, it doesn't appear the sort of thing one is out for. You can rely on my not saying or doing anything foolish, only I'm afraid you must be prepared for finding our venture much belittled. After all, it is the work that counts, not the applause that follows." Scott wrote on the last page of the diary that he left behind, "The future is in the lap of the gods. I can think of nothing left undone to deserve success." And on November the 1st, 1911, the time came for the start of his last journey. The first to leave Cape Evans were Day, Lashley, Teddy Evans and Hooper with the motor sledges, while the others with ponies and dogs followed behind. One machine gave out just beyond safety camp, while the other had to be abandoned a mile behind corner camp. On November the 1st, 10 men, each with a pony and a sledge, left Cape Evans in detachments. Scott, Wilson, Bowers, Oates, Atkinson, Cherry Garrard, Wright, Edgar Evans, Crean and Keir Hain. Mears and Dimitri followed with the dogs. Everyone else remained at Cape Evans to carry out further exploration and research in Victoria Land. Scott assumed the Terra Nova would return in January, bringing Victor Campbell and his northern party back to Cape Evans, whereby Campbell would take command. The distance from Hut Point to the pole and back was 1,766 statute miles, and every step of the way had to be marched on foot, with or without skis. They travelled by night for the benefit of the ponies, while temperatures never rose above 0 Fahrenheit. Fighting constant snowfall, the team reached One Ton Camp on the 15th day. There was a constant worry that the ponies would give out, and upon reaching Camp 20 on November 24th, the first pony was killed. Four camps later, on December the 1st, the second pony was shot. I mean, so the motor sledges that they brought, they've all completely failed. Half the ponies have died. Now the ponies, the ones that they've got left, are dying. A lot of the dogs have died. I mean, really, you would think maybe he should have actually thought, well, we're going to have to give this a miss. But I think he was just so desperate to get there. And he had that faith that because he was so certain he was going to do it, he was going to make it. But really, I think, you know, all the signs were there that perhaps he should have thought again, really, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right there. But again, sort of going back to the length of time that they've spent there doing this and the fact that it's been an obsession for them all, and that they're all living in close proximity in a kind of hothouse kind of environment, they would all have the same degree of like fanatical determination, and that obviously is what was driving them on.
But they're doing it all under their own steam now. That's the thing. I mean, they're literally having to walk to the pole, whereas the plan was to have ponies and motor sledges and dogs, and they're literally having to walk. Depots were made at regular intervals of roughly 70 miles, each containing food and fuel for a week for the returning parties. Scott wrote on December the 3rd, "Our luck in weather is preposterous. The conditions are simply horrible." On December the 5th, they awoke to a blizzard. The temperature normally rose just before and during a blizzard, but in this case, the temperature rose exceptionally high, resulting in melting snow, making everything wet. Scott wrote, "One cannot see the next tent, let alone the land. What on earth does such weather mean at this time of the year? It is more than our share of ill fortune, but the luck may turn yet." The wet, warm blizzard kept them confined to their tents for the next 4 days. This event quite likely led to their deaths. If they had not lost these 4 days, they would have reached One Ton Depot ahead of the blizzard that kept them pinned in at their last camp. On the third day of the blizzard, Scott wrote, "Resignation to misfortune is the only attitude, but not one easy to adopt. It is very evil to lie here in a wet sleeping bag and think of the pity of it whilst things go steadily from bad to worse." On the fifth day, the blizzard let up enough for the men to break camp. They had to beat the ponies as they floundered up to their bellies. And Wilson wrote, "Constantly collapsed and lay down and sank down, and eventually we could only get them on 5 or 6 yards at a time. They were clean done." They struggled for 11 hours, after which time the party camped. 5 ponies were shot, skinned, and made into a depot. Wilson wrote, "Thank God the horses are now all done for and we begin the heavier work ourselves." 2 days later found them on the foot of the Beardmore Glacier, and after setting up the lower glacier depot, Mears and Dimitri started back with the dogs and the mail. Day and Hooper had already turned back, so a party of 12, divided into groups, set out to man-haul the sledges up the glacier towards the summit, 10,000 feet above. Amundsen, unfortunately, was already there. The glacier is over 100 miles long and in some places 40 miles wide. The struggle began with each man pulling over 200 pounds through the soft snow, which they sank into nearly up to their knees. Some suffered from snow blindness as others stumbled into crevasses, sledges, and all. On December the 13th, the day before Amundsen actually reached the pole, in 9 hours the party had advanced less than 4 miles. Scott wrote, "I had pinned my faith on getting better conditions as we rose, but it looks as though matters are getting worse instead of better." Bowers wrote that he had never pulled so hard or so nearly crushed my inside into my backbone by the everlasting jerking with all my strength on the canvas band around my unfortunate tummy. The situation gradually improved as they scaled the glacier, and on December the 20th, Scott named the first returning party, Atkinson, Wright, Cherry Garrard and Keohane. Scott had dreaded this moment, as all had pulled to the limit of their strength, but now 4 good men had to be deprived of their just reward, the pole. The next day, the men established Upper Glacier Depot at 7,000 feet. After completion, the first supporting party left for home and reached Hut Point 35 days later, on January 26, 1912. The two remaining groups went on with 2 sledges and 12 weeks' supply of oil and fuel, pulling 190 pounds per man. In Scott's group were Oates, Wilson and Taff Evans, while Bowers had Teddy Evans, Lashley and Crean. They went on climbing for another 16 days to reach their highest altitude at 10,570 feet. I'll just stop there. You imagine that, pulling 190 pounds. Yeah. I mean, that's the weight of 2 men, isn't it, that they're dragging in the snow on a sled?
Well, it's the weight of a big man, I would say. About 14 stone, I would say that would be, something cool. Like that.
14 stone, dragging that in deep snow and making about 4 miles a day going uphill on a glacier. I mean, these guys are tough, aren't they? On Christmas Day, with a strong wind in their faces, they advanced 17 and a half miles. The Christmas meal consisted of pony hoosh, ground biscuit, a chocolate hoosh made from cocoa, sugar, biscuit and raisins, thickened with arrowroot, 2.5 square inches each of plum duff, a pannikin of cocoa, 4 caramels each and 4 pieces of crystallized ginger. From here, they made remarkable marches of 14 to 17 miles a day. On January 3rd, Scott chose 4 men to continue with him to the pole and instructed the other 3 to return. Bowers was brought into his tent, and Teddy Evans, Lashley and Crean would become the second returning support party. Teddy Evans was very bitter about Scott's decision, but the rest of the crew knew it was a proper choice. Aboard ship, he was of great help, but on land, he was a failure. Wilson wrote, "I never thought for a moment he would be in the final party." Bowers wrote, "Poor Teddy, I am sure it was for his wife's sake he wanted to go. He gave me a little silk flag she had given him to fly on the pole." Lashley and Crean were both in tears as the 3 men turned back at 87 degrees 32 seconds south at an altitude of 10,280 feet and 169 miles from the pole. There was no sign of the Norwegians as Scott and the others followed Shackleton's route. On January 6th, they crossed the line of latitude where Shackleton had turned back and were further south, as they believed, than any man had been before. For the next few days, the going was difficult. On January 9th, they stayed in their bags all day as a blizzard roared outside. On January 10th, they resumed their march, made a depot of 1 week's provisions, and reckoned that they were only 97 miles from the pole. On this day came the first hint that everyone was growing tired. Scott wrote, "I never had such pulling. All the time the sledge rasps and creaks. We have covered 6 miles, but at a fearful cost to ourselves. Another hard grind in the afternoon, and 5 miles added. About 74 miles from the pole. Can we keep this up for 7 days? It takes it out of us like anything. None of us ever had such hard work before. Our chance still holds good if we can put the work in, but it is a terribly trying time. A day later, he wrote, "It is an effort to keep up the double figures, but if we can do another 4 marches, we ought to get through. It is going to be a close thing." 2 days later, despite higher temperatures, Scott wrote, "It is most unaccountable why we should suddenly feel the cold in this manner." On January 13th, they crossed the 89th parallel. Next day, they started to descend and made their final depot of 4 days' food. Scott wrote, "We ought to do it now." And this was the last cheerful entry in Scott's diary. The next day, January 16th, they made a good march and figured they would reach the pole the following day. In the afternoon, Bowers spotted something ahead which looked like a cairn. Half an hour later, they realised the black speck to be a flag tied to part of a sledge. Nearby were the remains of a camp, along with tracks made by sledges and dogs, many dogs. Scott wrote, "This told us the whole story. The Norwegians have forestalled us and are first to the pole." Scott felt he had let his loyal companions down and had utterly failed them, and he wrote in his diary, "Many thoughts come and much discussions have we had. All the daydreams must go. It will be a wearisome return." And I'll just pause there, because you can imagine the effect this is going to actually have on their morale. They're already right at the end of their energy. And it's only the thought that they're going to be the first people at the pole that is keeping them going. They're miles away from the camp that they've actually headed out from. And now they've suddenly got this realization that they've actually been beaten there. So morale is going to be right at the bottom. And they're already starting to feel the fatigue from dragging these sledges all this way. I mean, that must have been absolutely heartbreaking for them to see this cairn there.
Yeah, they've already described the intense physical effort that was involved in dragging those sleds, and to have endured that for days and days on end, and endured the blizzards that they have done, and all the other trials and tribulations that we've talked about. It must have been absolutely gutting to find that the Norwegians had beaten them.
Absolutely crushing. And what do you do then, I guess? Do you keep on going, or do you turn back? On January 17th, a force 5 gale struck them, along with temperatures falling to 54 degrees of frost. Oates, Evans and Bowers all suffered from severe frostbite as they made an early lunch camp. Scott wrote, "Great God, this is an awful place, and terrible enough for us to have laboured to it without the reward of priority. Well, it is something to have got here, and the wind may be our friend tomorrow." Wilson wrote that it was a tiring day, and despite Amundsen having beaten us in so far as he has made a race of it, we have done what we came for all the same, and as our programme was made out. The next morning they found the Norwegians' camp about 2 miles away. Inside the tent was a sheet of paper with 5 names on it: Roald Amundsen, Olaf Olafsson Bjaaland, Hilmer Hansen, Sverre H. Hassel and Oscar Wisting. The date of the note was December the 14th, 1911. They had taken 21 days less than Scott's party to reach the pole. They had arrived at the pole with their dogs via a glacier they had named the Axel Heiberg. On the day Scott and his companions arrived at the pole, Amundsen and his men were only 1 week out from their winter quarters in the Bay of Wales. The 5 men reached the Fram in the Bay of Wales on January 25th, 1912. In the Norwegian tent, Amundsen left a note for Scott and a letter to be delivered to King Haakon. Bowers took photographs, and then they marched 7 miles south-southeast to a spot which put them within half a mile of the pole, altitude 9,500 feet. Here they built a cairn, planted our poor slighted Union Jacks and the rest of the flags, photographed themselves, and headed for home. Scott wrote, "Well, we have turned our backs now on the goal of our ambition with sore feelings, and must now face 800 miles of solid dragging, and goodbye to the daydreams." The return trip started out fairly well, but the temperatures were obviously becoming colder. Scott wrote, "There is no doubt that Evans is a good deal run down." On January 23rd, they had to camp early because of frostbite to Evans' nose. Oates' feet were always cold, and when a blizzard held them up 7 miles short of the next food depot, Scott wrote, "I don't like the look of it. Is the weather breaking up? If so, God help us with the tremendous summit journey and scant food." Despite the delays and difficult travel, the marches were good, but they were becoming very tired, as evidenced by the many injuries due to falls. Wilson strained a leg tendon and had to limp painfully besides the sledge for several days. Scott fell and bruised his shoulder, and Evans' hand lost 2 fingernails. On February 7th, they reached the head of the Beardmore Glacier, and the next day they started their descent. On February 11th, in difficult conditions, they took a wrong turn and ended up in the worst ice mess they had ever been in. For the next 2 days, they stumbled around in a maze of ridges, growing more weak and despondent. They knew the next depot could not be far away, but they simply couldn't find it. When they were down to their last meal, the men accidentally came upon the depot, which was shrouded in fog. Scott wrote, "The relief was inexpressible. There is no getting away from the fact that we are not pulling strong." At this point, it was determined to reduce rations since they were not making the distance between depots in a timely manner. And this only weakened them further, as Evans began losing heart and was nearly broken down in brain, we think. On February 16th, Evans collapsed and camp had to be made. But next day he felt better and said he could go on, but he would march for a while and then stop to adjust his boots while the others went on. But when he failed to catch up, the others would go back, only to find him kneeling in the snow with a wild look in his eyes. His companions sledged him to the next camp, and soon after midnight, he died. After a few hours' rest, they were on their way again. At the foot of the glacier, they reached the pony meet and enjoyed their first full meal since leaving the plateau. "New life seems to come with greater food almost immediately," they would write. From here, the travelling became difficult as the snow became very soft. "Pray God we get better travelling as we are not so fit as we were, and the season advances apace." They left the foot of the glacier on February 19th, and on the 27th, Wilson's diary stopped. Bowers had given up on his on January the 25th. They arrived at the Southern Barrier Depot 6 days later. Here they discovered a shortage of oil, presumably due to evaporation from the poorly sealed 1 gallon tins. Another 70 miles brought them to the Middle Barrier Depot, where they once again discovered a short supply of oil. By this time, Oates could no longer conceal his pain. His toes were black and gangrene was setting in. Temperatures were down to minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and the surface was so bad that even a strong wind in the sail would not move the sledge. Scott wrote, "God help us, we can't keep up this pulling, that is certain. Among ourselves, we are unendingly cheerful, but what each man feels in his heart, I can only guess." On March the 7th, Scott mentions the dogs for the first time. "We hope against hope that the dogs have been to Mount Hooper, the next depot, because then we might pull through. If there is a shortage of oil again, we can have little hope. I should like to keep the track to the end." On the same day, the dogs, driven by Cherry Garrard and Dimitri, were actually waiting at One Ton Depot, some 72 miles from Mount Hooper. On March the 9th, Scott and his men reached Mount Hooper. Cold comfort, shortage on our allowance all around. The dogs, which would have been our salvation, have evidently failed. An unusual northwest wind kept them in camp the next day, as it was simply too cold to face. With half-cooked food, all of them getting frostbitten, and all knowing they were doomed, they discussed the situation. Months before, at Cape Evans, they had discussed what to do if one of them became so injured as to not be able to continue on. Wilson carried lethal doses of morphine in his medicine chest, so one could eliminate himself if the situation called for it. At this point, Scott ordered Wilson to hand over the drugs, so Wilson handed each man his 30 opium tablets. But they were never used. as suicide was against the code. Things got worse as the north wind continued to blow in their faces. Wilson was now becoming weak, so Scott and Bowers had to make camp by themselves. The temperature fell to minus 43 degrees Fahrenheit, and on March the 16th or the 17th, because they lost track of the days, Oates said he could not go on and just wanted to be left in his sleeping bag. The others refused, and he struggled on. There was a blizzard blowing in the morning when Oates said, "I am just going outside and may be some time," and he stumbled out of the tent. Scott wrote, "We knew that poor Oates was walking to his death, but though we tried to dissuade him, we knew it was the act of a brave man and an English gentleman. Oates was never to be seen again." Yeah, this is really moving stuff, isn't it, Max? Very, very moving stuff.
Very, very sad, very moving, yeah. And you can imagine just the atmosphere in their camp would have taken on an almost surreal quality where they would each of them know that they were doomed and each of them making their own decision as to how they were going to end things.
Yeah, it's like the complete opposite of all the jubilation that's kept them going so far, that's given them all the endurance, and then to have all their hopes have been dashed, and then they're making their way back, and things are just going wrong one after the other. I mean, I think that since the start of the journey, when the sledges fell through the ice, I think that was, you know, that was the first of the bad omens. But it's just been one piece of bad luck after the other. And they really, once they knew that Amundsen was camped in the Bay of Wales and he was only 1 week from the South Pole and he was going to go for the South Pole, they should have just thought, well, that's it, we're beaten. But they wanted to keep going. They wanted to make it. They did make it to the pole. They just weren't the first ones there. They made it there. They planted the flags, which was the important thing. And it's just, it's just making it back now. And, yes, we know what happened, but I think we should leave it there, and we'll have a look at the final letters that were written next week, I think. Unless there's anything else you want to add, Max?
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, there's lots of talk nowadays about mental health and mental well-being, and you have princes talking about their mental health, and these men that accompanied Scott. So Scott and his band of men here were in a different league in terms of toughness to the sort of people that we see taking centre stage in Britain today. You know, these men were real men.
Absolutely. I mean, their sense of purpose, willpower, endurance is just absolutely incredible. As I say, we will hear the final bits of the story in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. The final instalment in this trilogy on Captain Scott will be playing on Radio Albion tomorrow.